Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 280 of the Roguecast before December 17, 2019. A big 10-headed fish from the depths.
We are back with Roguecast, and again, it is a slightly odd week in that we are missing Nick. He is not here this week.
But Anna's sitting in, who was sitting in last week, too,
yes.
Right? But yeah. We just comboed it up weird.
Yeah. Well, we're trying to add Anna into the mix if we can manage the timing on it. But for this week, Anna is our Nick.
Hi, I'm Nick.
So you have to talk about how great all five X-Books were.
Yeah.
And how you had to agonize between picking which one of you would pick.
Okay, I can do that.
So we're going to skip the news this week. There's a few things, but we're just going to skip it because we're running a little late. It's crazy holiday times.
You'll survive without these minor dribs and drabs of news, yep. And we'll throw it in next week.
Yeah, maybe. Well, or in 2 weeks, because I believe we're going to be off next week.
Ah, who knows?
Oh.
Because next week is Christmas week, and it's going to be a crazy schedule. But we will have comics, but not till Thursday, because, again, crazy schedule. And for those who are listening, just for quick store news, next week we will be closing at 7:30 on Tuesday for Christmas Eve.
Yep.
We'll be closed all day on Wednesday for Christmas, and the same will happen New Year's week. There will be comics on Thursdays, both weeks. And this week we are closing early at 8 p.m. on Thursday so that we can all go see Star Wars.
I'm so excited.
I know, me too.
Yeah. Don't screw it up, Abrams.
Yes. All right. So we're going to start with comics for the week of December 17th, which is effectively the last week of the year. I mean, there's a little bit more coming out the next week, but this is like the big week of comics.
Right.
There's a ton of stuff this week, guys.
So much stuff.
It's a super puffy week. We actually, we've been struggling all morning before prior to this, just trying to make it fit on the shelf.
Yeah, we had to put graphic novels onto the table. It's a crazy big week. Also with like notable, like the end of Doomsday Clock, the end of Last Night on Earth, the end of History of the Marvel Universe.
If the week were a mythical monster,
yes.
It would be like a Kraken or a Leviathan.
Or a Hydra Kraken Leviathan.
Yes.
Like a big 10-headed fish from the depths.
Correct.
Yes.
That's exactly right. Anyway, just not like a werewolf, though.
Yes, no. Because who likes werewolves?
I don't know. I've never met anyone who likes werewolves.
You should get a werewolf shirt and see if you can get into them.
Yeah. I definitely don't have at least four.
All right, so we're going to start with our picks. And Dave, why don't you start?
All right, I'm going back to my boy, Jeff Lemire. It's been a little while since I've represented him. So he's got a new book from Dark Horse that's part of the Black Hammer series of miniseries called Skull Digger and Skeleton Boy. Now, people probably know that most of these are all sort of based on analogs to Marvel and DC characters, and this is one that I would not have expected to have an interest in because it is a Batman-type analog.
Oh, really? Okay.
It is absolutely a Batman analog. It even begins with essentially an alleyway robbery, only a little bit like Batman 89. You know how that began, the Batman 89 with the robbery? But it wasn't his origin. It was like another kid that it happened to.
Right. It just happens in Gotham all the time.
It happens all the time. So here in Spiral City, which is their sort of big fictional city.
Okay.
That's going down. And this big bruiser-looking guy wearing what looks almost like tactical armor, but with skull imagery on it and a skull face. He is the titular Skull Digger.
Okay.
I said it.
You see big skulls?
He has, like, this chain with, like, a weighted skull on the end, and he kills people with it.
That sounds friggin' sick, actually.
It is, and the artwork is, and it's so good. It reminds me of Francesco Francavilla.
This is Tanzi Zanjic, who has done some fantastic work.
I'm so glad you pronounced that, because I was looking at it and dreading saying those letters. I was going to be like, Tanzi
Zanjic. This is my first Tanzi rodeo.
And what's interesting is there's an interesting interaction between he and the kid, just a sort of an unusual... The kid is kind of mute, but like kind of stares him in the eye, and they have this weird kind of connection that happens. And this kid is, I feel, just about certain to become Skeleton Boy, a.k.a. Robin. The issue is framed, though, by the police investigation into it. There's a lady cop who happens to be a lesbian, who I feel like is an obvious Renee Montoya analog.
Okay.
And she is real dedicated, while there is a kind of a pudgy commissioner who is not like the badass Commissioner Gordon, but more of a, hey, this investigation is about the parents. I know your pet project is trying to catch Skull Digger.
Wait, you referenced Batman 89. Remember they had a pudgy Commissioner Gordon, too.
That is true. Maybe that was as much the influence as Batman regular.
It might be.
Batman regular.
Yes. But he's like, he's clearly saying, don't investigate Skull Digger. We work with him, or we look the other way.
Okay.
And right. But this is like her pet project, and she has a connection to him, and she is doing it anyway. And then, without saying too much, there's a Joker analog into it called Grim Jim. He's sort of a all kind of muddily purple, dark colored skin, and he has a face that actually looks like a skull. It's pretty creepy. What else is going on? There's a mayor who's kind of just come out as a superhero, that he was like, oh yeah, back in the Golden Age, or not in the Golden Age, but like in the 60s, I was such and such character to boost his ratings. So it has a little bit of that Jeff Lemire kind of realism in there.
Okay, all right.
There's definitely some grittiness going on. And then there's the investigation, and then there is the actual matter of sort of recruiting this kid by Skull Digger. And also, it's narrated in part by the kid in the latter half, and it definitely suggests that this is not going to go the typical Batman, Robin route. It's as if the kid is sort of like, almost the way, I don't want to say quite how it would necessarily be in the real world, but he's sort of suggesting, as if looking back at it as an adult, that he was about to be taken in by a villain. And I don't know if it's because he sort of will ultimately come to see his methods as fascistic or violent, or it'll change who the kid is. But it does seem clear that even as he's joining up with Skull Digger, that future him is like, yeah, that was a mistake.
Okay.
Anyway, it was a very engaging first issue. Super awesome artwork. It reminded me, because it had been a little while since I'd been kind of pulled back into the Black Hammer universe, it reminded me that Jeff Lemire is one of the few people who can sort of do pastiche for me, yeah. And I like it. Mostly don't like that format.
This is a big Lemire week.
It is, yeah. He's also got Joker Killer Smile, pretty good second issue of that, which that's his Black Label title. Mm-hmm. Family Tree, which I didn't get around to, but I like the first issue of that. Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway, Skull Digger and Skeleton Boy. This is another one of those. You could probably, I'm sure, read it without having read any Black Hammer stuff and just know you're going to see a weird spin on a Batman-Robin type concept. But I'd almost as much recommend it for the artwork. by Tanya Zarjan.
That's close. It's very close. It's really close. It's a good job.
Tansy Zanjic.
Anna, what was your pick this week?
So my pick this week was Wonder Woman Dead Earth on DC's Black Label line, by written and drawn by Daniel Warren Johnson.
You like Daniel Warren Johnson because of Murder Falcons.
I do, actually.
Did you say Falcons?
Murder Plural? Falcon.
But you said Falcons.
Just no, one.
There's more than one, right?
No, aren't we all just
murder,
one.
We're all Murder Falcons.
No. Oh. The Murder Falcon was the one singular Murder Falcon friend that we made along the way.
You were like the parent that's like, I hope you have fun at the Murder Falcons concert.
I was actually doing that, yes.
Oh, okay.
All right, so yes, so that was weird, but that was your allure. Real quick, Murder Falcon was basic premise?
Heavy metal?
Yeah.
Fantasy?
Sort of. It's about a guy who basically has like an imaginary metal friend who is a giant falcon, and they fight by playing metal.
Yeah.
It's a lot deeper than that, but like that's the basic sort of quirky premise of it.
And so somebody was like, this guy needs to write Wonder Woman.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it does. If you read through that book, it's got like a heart to it that I think is like really appropriate for writing someone like Wonder Woman. And like a lot of the sort of like, I guess like feel good vibe that comes out in that book definitely comes out in this.
Okay, that's interesting.
So like,
because like just at a quick glance, it looks all meddled up. And I was going to say, I kind of feel like sometimes the big heroes and stuff can maybe use a little bit of metal.
Yeah, and I think especially Wonder Woman can.
Yeah. Sometimes they're so prim and proper.
Yeah, and I think that Wonder Woman definitely should do more, like, crazy punching bad guys in the face and stuff like that.
Punch their heads off.
Yeah, like, it would be cool. Like, I mean, Greek legends generally feature their heroes, like, slaying terrifying monsters, and I think that this is definitely an appropriate use of Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
However, this book is set in, like, a post-apocalyptic Earth, just, like, inside and outside of Gotham City, where Wonder Woman awakes from basically, like, a cryogenic chamber into this world that is ruined.
Yeah.
And she is, like, at a loss. She's wakes up to find that she doesn't have her powers, and also that, like, basically humanity, the humanity that she, like, effectively fell in love with, no longer exists.
Yeah, they kind of wish he would snarkily say, "Nice job, man's world."
Dave wants a sassy one to put fucking Wonder Woman.
Actually, you're flipping through it, and that artwork is...
It's beautiful.
It's so amazing.
Yeah,
There was this big landscape shot of, like, sort of ruined craters and stuff like that that looked really amazing, and... Mm-hmm. Look, Wonder Woman herself looks really cool, too.
Oh, I love her costume. She's, like, sort of... It's a mixture of, like, what she, like, traditionally wears, but it's, like, a ragged version of the costume that she found out in, or found in Wayne Manor.
Yeah.
I can't help but notice also, when she emerges from that, like, cryogenic chamber, she's in, like, a white jumpsuit, which is a little bit of, a tribute to the white jumpsuit era of Wonder Woman, too. Yeah.
But anyway, like, Daniel Warren Johnson, definitely, like, one of my favorite, like, illustrators that I see.
Yeah, that's another one, if only for the artwork, it's worth checking out.
It's amazing, and he definitely, like, has, like, a really sketchy, kind of gritty-looking metal album kind of sensibility to his work.
Like, I think there's a high degree of craftsmanship, but it looks raw.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it's kind of fascinating... Especially, like, a lot of the redesigns and stuff. But anyway.
One of the things I really like is that Wonder Woman doesn't get as much alternate world play as, like, Batman and Superman have had 100 different alternate worlds. We've seen Batman in, you know, in Victorian London and Superman in Communist Russia and all this. Like, we've had so many Batman and Superman alternate takes. Wonder Woman doesn't get a lot of these. So I'm kind of cool to see her getting her, like, post-apocalyptic alternate world on.
Yeah. Though, interestingly enough, this isn't, I guess, Wonder Woman's only post-apocalyptic appearance this week. She does also have a post-apocalyptic barbarian version in The Last Knight on Earth.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
So.
Yeah. You said there's a little bit of heart to this. Like, what is her mission in a post-apocalyptic world?
I mean, she emerges from her cryogenic chamber seeing, like, basically mankind decimated and, like, forming up in groups of brigands and fighting each other, and she's like, this is not the humanity that I fell in love with when I met Steve Trevor. This is something that I can fix.
Oh, so she actually has a notion that she can fix apocalyptic stuff?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess not necessarily fix, like...
But she could be like
itself.
A force for justice
but
or something,
yeah, like,
or for renewal.
Be a force for making humanity, like, make I guess, them, remember its roots.
Make them stop eating each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if that takes her bisecting some demon-looking monsters with swords, well then so be it.
Yeah. It's definitely got heart.
It also has. Can I say who the villain or one of the quarter sort of villains is in it?
No, don't spoil it.
All right, I won't say.
Yeah, because when
but
I
you
read
may see
moment,
some Wonder Woman characters you recognize. Yeah. Is all.
Yep.
Yeah, I was gonna say definitely don't spoil it because when I read that I was very excited.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. It's
so,
a cool scene.
My pick is very similar to that, except that instead of post-apocalyptic, it's like a coal mining town, and instead of Wonder Woman, it's two lesbian girls, and instead of post-apocalyptic monsters, there's weird, creepy deer monsters.
And otherwise, it does sound similar.
Yeah.
What is
this
book?
Like, it's nothing like it. It's,
this is the Joe Hill book, right?
This is the Joe Hill book. It is the Low, Low Woods number one. Did I say that slow enough?
Yeah, well, earlier Randy was saying low, as it sounded like Lolo.
It's not the Lolo Woods. It's the Low,
the low Woods.
You gotta slow it down like Barry White.
Yeah, though. You have to say it creepy, too, like creepy Barry White.
Anyway, this is written by Carmen Maria Machado and art by Danny and colors by Tamra Bonvillon.
Sure.
And it is a gorgeous book. It reminds me a little bit of a sketchier Eduardo Risso.
Okay, I was flipping through it, and that sounds right.
And it is, basically, it's a story. It starts off with these two, I want to say maybe teenage girls, who wake up in a movie theater. They don't remember what happened. Something weird has happened. And they're just kind of go with it. They're like, yeah, we don't remember, just the thing that happens. And apparently in this town, that's the thing that happens to women. They just sometimes forget things.
Huh.
Then there's, she tells the story, this is a coal mining town, basically, where fire started down underneath where the coal mines were. And now the town is on fire underneath, and the city's cracking. The company's trying to move people out. It's basically one of these dying cities, which...
But it's like a persistent thing. It's not like it's an emergency. You just try and get out of it
the next
few minutes.
It's just the town is slowly dying.
Yeah, that sounds like... The Silent Hill was loosely based on one of those towns where they have, like, a coal fire that's been burning for decades.
Well, and that's the thing. This is a real thing that happens.
Yeah.
And so it is sort of a environmental decline. But it also sounds like there's some mysterious thing going on where, like... there's memory losses and maybe mysterious goings on. There's some kind of weird deer creature that they almost hit on their bike. And so,
where is it set, Randy? What it's like?
It doesn't say, but I get a very sort of West Virginian-y vibe off of it.
This sounds up my alley. I'm gonna for sure read it.
Somewhere that I didn't notice, but it definitely feels like sort of Virginia coal country.
And is it mostly lensed through the two girls?
Yes, you mostly see the two girls. One of them is having an affair with another girl in the school, who's sort of this hot girl. Her friend doesn't think much of it. And then the other girl is like has her dad, who she's close to, and her English teacher, who she's sort of idolizes. And it reminds me a lot of the other Joe Hill books so far. That it's all like
character strong characters
and premise is being established and creepy and
like
really
more of a creepy subtle kind of horror is what they seem to do. Not like this ain't slasher horror.
Yeah, I quite enjoyed it. Also on my stack this week, a bunch of number ones. Suicide Squad number one by Tom Taylor and who's the artist on that? Bruno Redondo, who did Injustice 2 with him. Then Read Only Memories from IDW, which is a really cool little cyberpunk detective story, which is right up my alley. Also in the cyberpunk vein, Blade Runner comes back for Blade Runner number 5, starting a new story in the Offworld colonies. We had
You made it sound like there was a character named Blade Runner. Blade Runner's back.
Blade Runner's back.
Replicants, beware. Blade Runner is back.
There's a new book from Mark Miller and Peter Gross called American Jesus, the New Messiah. This is one of those... They solicited it under the name Project Xmas. They wouldn't tell us what it was, except that it was something with him working on one of his original creators on the return to one of his projects. Uh-huh. Nick and I were guessing Wanted. It's not Wanted. It's American Jesus. The American Jesus is a long ago project.
Yeah, like 10 or 15 years ago or something.
Which I enjoyed at the time. It was basically this kid growing up in the Midwest who started just developing powers, seemed like he was the new Jesus. The big twist ending is, oh no, he's actually the Antichrist.
I think I enjoyed it up until the twist ending.
I kind of did too, but now this is actually going to be, this is the story of his adversary, of the actual Jesus who's being born into it.
Interesting.
And it is a Hispanic girl who becomes pregnant, she's dating like a black kid, feels like in the maybe little 70s, and he's a good kid, but her dad
hates... the 1970s, or she's dating someone in their
70s? It's the 1970s.
That's what I thought. It seems like he's in the 70s or something
like
that.
Yes. But basically, it's like her dad doesn't approve of it. Nobody really believes her that this is they weren't just having sex.
Right.
And it goes in an interesting direction. I'm curious to see where that goes. There's also... Let's see, what else have I got? The final issue of History of the Marvel Universe this week. Another issue of Daredevil, which is one of my favorite books of the week. And honestly, favorite books of the decade, as I'm working my Best of the Decade list. Chip Zdarsky is killing it on Daredevil. Rucka returns with Old Guard, the second series, which is going to be a movie on Netflix, apparently.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that's right.
Grant Morrison and Dan Mora have their yearly Claws one-shot.
Yep.
And then the creator of Lore has a new book about Duke of Wellington being a secret monster hunter. That's everything on my stack. Anna, what else would I miss? What's on your stack?
Did I read anything that you didn't read?
You read Gwenpool, and I didn't read Gwenpool.
But you should have.
I did. Should I?
You should have read Gwenpool.
Should I have read Gwenpool?
Is that an ongoing series, or is it a miniseries?
It's a miniseries.
Okay.
And in fact, this is...
How much longer can it go?
This is the last issue, actually.
Okay.
And they wrap it up in, like, a real nice, fun way that sort of ties it into some stuff that's going on in the current Marvel Universe.
Okay.
And I was pleasantly surprised by it. Also, I did not expect a book full of, basically, memes to elicit such an emotional response from me, but it did.
Okay, all right.
But it seems like they've managed to have some interesting, like a little deeper, something under the surface the whole time.
Yeah, for sure, definitely. Just like, this was like a bit more.
Yeah, okay.
Teen Titans, which I think probably is actually my favorite book, and has been basically ever since I picked it up around issue 23.
Is that okay. What's his name? Adam...
Yeah, well, it was actually a couple issues into Adam Glass's run, and he's currently writing it now. But yeah, I back read, and basically I've been current with it since that issue. Once in Future, which is Kieran Gillen's new book, which I think also is either the end or about to be.
Yeah, I think six issues. It's issue 5. Yeah. And 6 issues is the final one.
His kind of upending of sort of Arthurian concepts.
Safe Sex, which is delightful, though a very not safe for work.
Not remotely. No.
Honestly, I'm surprised I can get away with reading it here. But then I have...
You can't, you're fired.
Oh, shit. I knew I shouldn't have done the podcast.
The trap worked, Randy. Bring out the cameras, boys.
It seemed mean to fire on the podcast.
Well, at least you didn't wait to do it by, like, text after Dave, I had walked out for the day.
Dave did think it'd be hilarious.
Well, in Dave's defense, I did laugh. But now I'm very sad.
Now we get to the Nick portion of the podcast.
Since I'm also Nick, I did read... definitely all of the X-books, not just the three of them that are on my stack.
I don't believe you.
But, like, every single one of the X-Men books except for X-Men, like, the actual title
book came out this week.
Yeah, which is crazy. It's so much to read.
It's for Xmas, y'all.
Oh my god.
Shut up, Dave.
That makes sense.
I'm glad you fired me. So, New Mutants, which continues, like, the previous issue and sort of, like, merges the threads that the two books, or rather that the, I guess, the first two books and then the second two books have had, they sort of all come together.
Okay.
In an interesting way. Marauders, which continues to be a complete delight. X-Force, which finally now I get to actually have Domino in the book. I'm very happy about that. And then Batman Last Night on Earth, which...
Right, that's the resolution.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's the last one.
So, out of curiosity, is your favorite X-book Marauders?
It's like a toss-up between Marauders and X-Force.
Okay, alright.
I like X-Force just because I like Quentin Quire.
Yeah, Quentin Quire.
He's a little...
Quentin.
He's a little bastard, man.
He is
What's
a
not
bastard.
To like?
Yeah.
That's why I like Damien, too.
Quentin Quire and Damien would definitely get along.
No, they would
they
hate
each
other.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
They might actually get along.
Yeah.
Mm. They definitely strike me as the kind of people who'd be like, no, he's a sociopath. Like, it's fine when I do
you're
it,
like, but
when
you're
he does it...
a sociopath. Yeah, no, he's bad and I'm good.
The only other thing I had to mention that y'all did not is the, maybe you even did, Randy, the second issue of Star Trek Picard.
I left it for you because I know your love for Star Trek Picard.
Thanks, because otherwise I would have nothing and my life would be meaningless.
Yep.
This is just the this is the second issue of the series that's filling in the gap between the ending of Star Trek Nemesis and the like 20 years later Picard show that's starting up in January. So it's all about evacuating all of the Romulan worlds from like a massive supernova and the intrigues and dangers that come from doing that. I'm still digging it, and I kind of like the old school moral quandary that Picard is in this. So, I recommend anybody who's, like, kind of wanting to find out what the Lost Trek history is there. This is, like, canonical. It's co-written by one of the show writers and all that. So, it's pretty notable.
Also, I don't know that we don't necessarily read all this stuff, but, like, there's a new Dogman this week. There's
the
second volume of Grant Morrison's Green Lantern comes out. There's this interesting... there's the Silver Surfer Black Treasury Edition.
Yeah, it's like a big oversized one, which... is it Tradmore?
Yeah.
That artwork is so good in it that I think it'll really look beautiful in that. But it's shrink-wrapped, so I can't just casually flip through it.
There's the hardcover of the Jim Henson Storyteller Sirens, Dave, which I think you picked almost every issue of.
That was just one of those ones. Everyone still, they do a miniseries themed around dragons, sirens, whatever mythological creature. And then they'll do a wide variety of stories that might be themed more in, like, Eastern themes or medieval European themes. Or, they vary it up quite a bit. But they always have good art, and I usually like they're done in one story. So, yeah, I recommend it.
And then the other thing is there's the Watchmen hardcover, the Watchmen Companion, which we didn't really know that much about when we ordered.
It seems like it's a miscellany of more or less you can only get it here Watchmen stuff that DC has produced.
Yeah.
So it's apparently got like the materials from the Mayfair role-playing game of the 1980s.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, I have those like printed out on like from a PDF copy that somebody got me of it. But it was like something that they did it like in conjunction with Alan Moore, like other, like villains and stories and stuff for it to inhabit in a role-playing game.
Before he soured on the whole thing.
Before he soured on it. Yeah. And I forget what all else is in there, but there's a bunch of other kind of weird rarities. And apparently there was
DC Spotlight or something.
DC Spotlight introduced the concepts of Watchmen or something a month or two before it started, which is a crazy thing to imagine. Like, there might be, like, some weird little prelude comic out there.
Yeah, it's weird.
I hope it's introduced by Batman eating a Twinkie.
Wild.
That was the style in the 80s.
Yeah, it's true. Alright, so we'll be back in just a second to talk about some TV and some movies. right, so we're going to talk about some comics and TV, or some TV and movie stuff, comics related.
Yes.
It's been on the last few weeks. It's kind of a big, big time for TV and movies for comics. Like,
yeah.
We're going to talk about Crisis on Infinite Earths. We're going to talk about the ending of Watchmen, maybe, if we have time for it.
Yep.
Possibly
Mandalorian.
Possibly the Mandalorian. And then, of course, Harley Quinn has a new animated series. But before we get to all of that, if we get to all of that,
we have to talk about a movie with zany Jack Black hijinks.
Let's talk about Jumanji The Next Level.
Yes.
Dave, you and I both saw this separately.
Yep. Real quick flashback. You and I both like Jumanji, yep. Welcome to the Jungle.
You saw it in the theater. I saw it when Nick gave me his free digital copy.
Yep. And I was hoping it would be good, like that it might have a little bit of Galaxy Quest-esque charm when I saw it.
Yeah,
that's the high water mark. I know most things are not going to hit Galaxy Quest.
And it's not Galaxy
Quest. It's not Galaxy Quest. But it came a little closer than I expected
it
to.
It's fun.
It's some kids who get put in their video game avatars that are very different from who they are, and they got to kind of learn to break through their... do a little Breakfast Club breaking through social strata while they have crazy video game hijinks in like what would be the equivalent of Tomb Raider, Uncharted type of
games.
Yeah,
it's like a big adventure like that. Game.
Yep. And there's actually some pretty good humor in there. Who's it? Who's the NPC? Reese Darby is great in it as the NPC guy who gives them their marching orders and stuff. And but at the end of it, of course, they manage to escape back to the real world. Everybody's changed a little bit, and we move to the new one.
Yeah. I would say the thing about Jumanji that really works is the cast.
Yeah.
The adventure the characters they're inhabiting, their avatars in the video game world are The Rock, Karen Gillan,
yep.
Kevin Hart, and Jack Black.
Yes.
All of whom are in top form here.
Right, doing big, larger-than-life sort of video game characters, or that is to say, that's what they physically look like. Yep. But inside, it's like The Rock portraying a nerdy, skinny kid inhabiting that body and being, like, nervous about everything for a little while until he starts to realize he's a badass, and then he's, like, having a full-on blast with it. So, and everybody has some little journey like that together.
So we're going to have spoilers for Jumanji The Next Level if you're going to see it. Just skip past this part.
Yep.
The big twist here is that Spencer, the kid who was The Rock last time, is having sort of depression issues, and basically, while all of his friends are sort of like getting on with their lives and going to college and everything, he is miserable at NYU, and he comes home and he goes back into the game.
Right, he's kind of hoping to get a little bit of going back to, was it Dr. Bravestone?
Dr. Bravestone, Smolder Bravestone.
Smolder Bravestone.
What an incredible name.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah.
One of the things he does is he smolders. He stops and gives that rock
a smoldering stare.
It's one of his powers.
That's so good.
There's a hilarious, like, sort of little musical vibrating cue or whatever for when
fantastic.
He does it. It's really, even though these are not like serious movies in any, even when they're being serious, they're not too serious, but there are these moments that have some heart to it.
Yeah.
And I actually did find their sort of portrayal of his isolation pretty decently done.
Yeah.
He was a guy who's like watching after he broke up with the girl from the first one, he apparently like she's posting all these pictures of herself kind of moving on in college and getting new friends. And it sort of, I think, spoke a little bit to how social media can really make it feel like wherever everybody, of course, is putting on their best face.
Yeah.
And you tend to not see the rougher times.
Yeah.
And so he's in a rougher time. He's seeing her put on her definitely best face and is just like feeling completely removed from all of them.
The thing I love in a sequel is seeing characters I liked grow. And I thought they did a good job with that. Like them getting together for brunch at this like restaurant and like the two girls now are like besties.
Right.
And the guy who was sort of the jock is a friend. Like I like that they're all friends now.
Yeah.
I thought that was really cool. And then the twist they introduced is that Danny DeVito, his granddad, is staying with Spencer, the nerd kid.
Yep.
Because he's had hip surgery. He's griping about getting old and how much he hates it. And then his buddy Milo, this sort of this guy who's like they were partners in a restaurant and they had some kind of falling out. Played by
Danny Glover,
shows up, and as this happens, when they decide they have to go back in the game to get Spencer, they accidentally draw the two old people.
A glitch pulls them in, and most everybody ends up in a different character, although the one girl who was kind of the...
Martha,
who was, I'm going to say, the sort of independent thinker girl who was like the kind of down with convention girl, once again ends up in Karen Gillan.
Ruby Roundhouse.
Ruby Roundhouse, Killer of Men.
I am sure that Anna would enjoy this movie.
I love that title, Killer of Men.
Killer of Men. Yes, I kill men.
anyway, And there's some interesting little weird switcheroos that also happen later on for kind of video game glitchy reasons.
I think that the MVPs of this movie, The Rock playing Danny DeVito is having so much fun.
Yeah.
And Kevin Hart just kills it playing sort of the... We were talking about, like, Danny Glover had to have been, like, on the outskirts giving the performance or something because it's so dead on.
Right. He kind of is playing a guy who's, like... kind of slowly reaches for his words and kind of speaks in a little bit of a slow style, which is endlessly frustrating for them when they're in the video game and there's emergency stuff happening.
The bits where the ostriches show up and they're like, they can't figure out what the threat is, and he's like, well, here's an interesting thing about ostriches. And he's just like slowly laying it out, and it's always like just a second too late.
It's like he always sort of buries the lead and starts with the weird obscure stuff.
Yes.
And then eventually as he's getting to the important stuff, it's too late.
Yes.
So Randy, I think overall you definitely liked this movie more than I did.
I really loved it.
But it's funny, while we were talking about it, I was like, maybe I was just like not quite in the mood for it, because I was like, oh yeah, that was pretty good. Oh, I did like that scene. Yep. That's a pretty clever way to update it. So I may actually slightly revamp my opinion and warm up to it a little bit more. I thought it was good, but not great. And
yeah, I win. I made Dave like a movie.
Yeah, it's I'm a soft touch.
By the way, do we want to talk about the new character that Spencer winds up inhabiting, or should we not talk about that? Because it's a character. It's an act. It's an actor I really like. I was so pleased to see her here. So
sure. Let's say who it is. We can even I think say what her role is in it.
So Awkwafina shows up playing the cat burglar, who's a new. And I love Awkwafina in anything.
Yeah.
You put Awkwafina in anything, it's immediately like twice as good.
Did you ever see The Farewell?
I have not seen The Farewell yet.
You ought to catch that. See her some dramatic chops.
She's great in Ocean's 8. I love her.
Yeah.
And she's great here. I also like the sort of change of... They make it... It's like a desert instead of a jungle.
Right. There's a... And it's still always like the threats in it are kind of like ridiculous. Like sometimes they look like Genghis Khan barbarians.
Right.
And sometimes they're like mercenaries with machine guns. And sometimes they're combinations of the two, the various bad guy types.
Sometimes it's an army of mandrels.
An army of mandrels, yeah. And Awkwafina, it's actually, of course, the character of the thief that she's playing is not what's core to it, because she is somebody else is in her body, of course. That's the nature. Everybody is playing somebody else, and several people at least end up playing inhabited by two people at different times. So the actors all get to do some fun stuff. I felt the tricky thing in that is making sure it's always clear who is who, and you never do forget.
No, they did a great job.
I think because it's kind of larger-than-life characters.
Yeah.
And also, The Rock talks like Danny DeVito when he's Danny DeVito.
Oh my God, it's amazing.
And so there's no missing it.
No, it's so good. I mean, like, when
he's trying to, they're trying to explain to him he's in a video game, he's like, huh? And then, like, 30 minutes into the movie, he'll be like, so we're in a game?
Yeah. The frustration of the kids trying to explain it to the oldsters is so hilarious.
Yeah.
They're like, if he asks me if we're in a video game again, I swear I'm going to lose it.
Incidentally, it is not simply mocking them. In fact,
no.
They are very key to some of the heart in this.
Absolutely, yeah. I thought their
relationship
was really good.
And they do
good.
A lot of good stuff with it.
There's some good little cameos at the end. Also, they bring in Colin Hanks again to play his character, and I thought that was really good.
Yeah, the person who had been stuck in it for 20 years in the previous one.
And their bad guy's really cool. Mm-hmm. He's a good, scary bad guy. I don't remember who the actor is. Rory something? Rory McCann?
Yeah.
I don't know where I know
him
from.
The guy who played the Hound on Game of Thrones?
It is the Hound. That's who it is.
Oh, that makes sense, because he just has the physical intimidation qualities.
He's like a barbarian lord.
So let me ask you, Randy.
Awesome.
Would you see a third one?
I'm excited for a third one, because they definitely tease it at the end. I think they knew they were going to do it.
That's right. In fact, they even teased it, because I was like thinking, like, if they did different locales, if they did like a sci-fi adventure or something like that, I'd be down for it.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's what they're doing based on how it ended.
They're going to do a different take, which is a perfect good... I don't want them to make a billion.
Yeah,
I think
that's
a third one to wrap it up is perfect.
I think you could absolutely do that.
Yeah.
You mean you don't want them to Pirates of the Caribbean this franchise?
Let's not Pirates of the Caribbean anything. What is it? They can Mission Impossible it. That's when you go past four and it gets good. But
interesting.
I don't think they should.
But what if they Fast and Furious to...
Also, that works.
Okay.
Fast and Furious, that's the rule. Once it gets past four, it turns good.
Okay.
Because Mission Impossible was inconsistent up till four.
I don't know. There's Lethal Weapon movies out there, Randy.
That's the reverse. Usually, you'll Lethal Weapon or you Pirates of the Caribbean it, but occasionally, you can Fast and Furious Or what was the other one I said? Mission Impossible.
Mission Impossible. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you know, it's
the examples do exist, but yes, it's a yin yang of movie franchise quality.
Maybe when Top Gun Maverick comes out, we'll find out that Top Gun is a series gets great at four when they bring in other people in different fighter planes.
Is Goose's kid or something going to be in it?
Goose's kid will be in it. He will fly a helicopter.
Goose didn't have a kid, did he?
No, he did not have a kid.
What else do we have to discuss?
It'll be Goose's clone.
I was going to say, Goose's kid is a Gosling, actually.
It'll be Ryan Gosling.
It'll be Ryan Gosling.
All right. You guys want to talk about this Harley Quinn animated thing on the DC Universe app.
And you will, too, when you see it, Randy.
Not going to happen.
Yeah, you need to make it happen. You're only in, like, a TV podcast. Somebody you know can point you to this. I feel like if you can see the Deadpool movie, you can see the Harley Quinn TV show.
All right, Anna, sell me on the Harley Quinn TV show.
It's better than the Deadpool movies.
Interesting. Okay, all right.
You think most people would agree with that? I don't know, because I haven't seen them, because I'm so, dig my heels in.
So edgy.
I'm an edgelord.
For starters, do I strike you as the kind of person who cares whether or not other people would agree with me?
Interesting, good point.
I mean, I don't know. It's got a lot of the same similar, like, humor beats as the Deadpool movies. I guess
Deadpool, it is an R-rated comedy.
Yeah, it's Deadpool, like, I guess has, like, a more of a gross sense of humor at times.
Interesting,
whereas Harley Quinn sort of likes to, I guess, parody sort of, like, DC story beats. Which is, I guess,
a little meta, but in a different way than, I guess, Deadpool. There's no, like, I don't think they ever, like, address the camera or anything like that.
No, not that I'm aware of, at least in the three episodes that I saw.
Is it an ongoing plot, or is it, like, episodic?
So, I guess technically there is an ongoing plot, though they're almost entirely disconnected from one another.
Okay.
But the effective thing is in the first episode, Harley Quinn and the Joker, they break up. Because she realizes the Joker is a terrible person, which she should, and I'm tired of the Joker, and I don't want to see him anymore.
Yep. But, what about his head?
Well, that was okay in Last Night on Earth, but the guy playing the Joker is actually delightful in the Harley Quinn series.
Do you know who it is?
Yes, I did, until you asked me.
All right, well, keep talking.
I'm going to talk about the first episode real quick and just say, because it's the only one I've seen. I was kind of watching it, fully expecting to not like it, and I can't say I actually laughed a lot, but that's because I don't really do comedy stuff most of the time.
You don't care for humor.
I don't care for your earthling humor. But I thought the jokes were absolutely superior, and it, like, reminded me, I think it compared well with stuff like Archer and Venture Brothers. I think it had qualities of both of those.
That's a high praise.
And I think, who was I saying this with you, with Nick? That as far as, I think it was with Fathery, who I podcast with, that as far as telling the story of Harley's emancipation from Joker, it's probably my favorite version that I've seen.
Yeah, for sure.
Was that with you?
Yeah, it was with me.
Okay. I've talked about this movie with a lot of, or this show with a lot of people. But
Alan Tudyk, by the way, is
doing Alan Tudyk, that's it.
Yes. Basically what happens is sort of is in the first episode, Joker, after a crazy, anarchic, violent opening with the two of them working together, he leaves her behind, and she thinks that, he'll be coming to rescue her in Arkham Asylum any day. And this is sort of like works as a metaphor for a person trying to hang on to somebody who's bad for them and just always believing the best. And, like, everybody in there, like, I forget all the inmates, but it's probably, like, Calendar Man and like, Croc. And everybody's like, you know, Harley's not coming for you or whatever. And then, like, after a year passes, she sort of finally settles in.
Yeah.
And I forget, what does actually get her out of Arkham in that first one?
Someone smuggles someone, like, an orange, basically. And they eat the orange, and then Poison Ivy manipulates the seeds from the orange to break out of the prison.
Okay, I had forgotten that exactly. It does seem, although they're not running with her and Poison Ivy together as a couple, that Poison Ivy is like her guide. Would you say, are they like roommates, essentially? Or she's clearly helping her out.
Yeah, they're close friends. I guess they like established that they had made friends while they were in Arkham.
Okay.
And it's sort of like I don't know, if you, as a person, have, like, a friend who's, like, the kind of, like, goofball screw-up friend.
Yeah.
Like, then you're the Poison Ivy and that friend is the Harley Quinn. Don't name names. I don't want to hurt any feelings.
Wait, the goofball screw-up is Harley.
Yeah.
Right. And Poison Ivy is, the person who's like, you got to get out of this thing.
You're an idiot, but you're my idiot.
Right.
I guess.
I found that there was actually, I don't want to say that there was a lot of like deep emotional resonance, because it wasn't the kind of thing that does a ton of heartfelt moments, but that it actually functioned to tell a somewhat serious allegory with its just like hilariously ridiculous stuff in between, about bad dangerous relationships and gaslighting and all that sort of stuff, but without like saying this is a story about gaslighting, it wasn't heavy-handed, so I was kind of impressed with sort of how it did it. And you're now a few episodes in, Anna. Liking it?
I have some conflicted feelings about it. I think that actually if Randy gave it a shot, he would probably like it.
It's possible.
With in mind that it has a very similar, like, sense of humor to Archer.
Yeah. Like things that normally might have bothered me, like, Jim Gordon, isn't he, like, on the verge of a nervous breakdown constantly? Yeah.
Well, I mean, wouldn't you be if you lived in Gotham?
Yeah, and like, I thought, though, that it's, like, it would sort of be disrespectful to the character is what I want to say. But it's all so anarchic. I can't take really any of it seriously. Yeah. They're, in a way, because it's not even in his nature to be that in the comic, I don't feel like it's spoofing anything in particular. It's just a funny character.
Yeah.
What did you have reservations about, though?
It's just some sort of, I guess, like, almost B-plot stuff. So Harley Quinn, I guess, at least in the most recent episode, they're trying to, like, tell a narrative of, like, women's empowerment.
Okay.
Which, I guess you could say, like, goes through the whole series.
Sure.
Because she's, you know, become emancipated from the Joker. She's trying to establish herself as a villain and as her own character outside of just being Joker's girlfriend / sidekick.
Yeah.
And, like, she's encountering resistance because people don't want to take her seriously. And at first it's because, oh, she's a sidekick. And then in the more recent episodes it's become, oh, it's because you're a girl and none of the big villains are women.
Right.
And I think it's weird to have that as your A-plot, but then have a character like Dr. Psycho be a supporting cast member that the characters are friends with. In fact,
Dr. Psycho, who in almost all recent incarnations is kind of written as sort of creepy,
rapey, gross man.
Yeah, that is a weird call.
Well, and it's even weirder when, like, his introduction is, like, Poison Ivy and Harley Quinn, they're sitting on a couch watching the news, and Dr. Psycho is fighting Wonder Woman. And Wonder Woman's like, you're not gonna get away with this, Psycho, and he's like, shut the F up, you C-word. And they bleep it all, of course, because it's for humor's sake. But the entire world, like, stops and gasps, which in and of itself is almost a funny gag, that literally everyone stopped to be like, what the actual fuck? And Harley Quinn and Poison Ivy, they, like, look at each other, and Poison Ivy's like, wow, he just became the most hated person on the planet. And Harley Quinn's like, yeah, but I'm also hated, which means we should be friends. And it's like, sure, that's ridiculous. And it's funny, I guess, as a story beat, but I think it kind of undercuts the meaning of your women's empowerment to be like, I should be friends with that rapist.
Yeah, he's
who,
like,
calls people the C-word.
He's sort of, at best, a mind-controlling incel type. He's, and, like, at worst, is a sort of rapist. I don't get that one. It doesn't, honestly, what I saw in the first episode would not have led me to believe they would have gone that direction.
Yeah.
Hopefully that's something that they don't hang on to too long.
Same. That said, to move it away from that extremely dark topic, Clayface, an incarnation of Clayface that doesn't really have any root in
Play up him as the actor?
As the actor, yeah. It's very funny.
Is he like a little bit like, I don't know, Alan Rickman in Galaxy Quest or whatever?
Yeah, a little bit. Like, he's got like a very
prima donna-ish
proper voice and prima donna type. So.
You know, it's interesting. I'm looking at the IMDb and I don't see Clayface's voice listed anywhere.
I wonder
that they wouldn't have it.
Weird.
They do have, I mean, the voice cast on this is really, really good.
Oh, yeah.
Giancarlo Esposito is Lex Luthor, Christopher Maloney is Commissioner Gordon, Andrew Daly is Two-Face, I see J.B. Smoove plays someone called Frank the Plant.
Yeah, he plays Poison Ivy's plant sidekick.
I love J.B. Smoove.
He's very funny in this.
Diedrich Bader is playing Batman, which is delightful.
Yeah, after Brave and Bold, right?
Yep,
that was who he played in.
Well, go ahead.
And Tony Hale is Dr. Psycho.
That's
pretty great.
Was it Costco that got mentioned in the first one, or?
Oh yeah, with the gag about
who was trying to convince Poison Ivy to get a card at Costco.
The Riddler.
It's
like, you should get a Costco card.
Was this,
like,
to get some kind of equipment for their villainous plan or whatever?
Margarita mix.
Right, margarita mix, which does play a weirdly important role in the final scene. Yeah. And Poison Ivy, they're like having a screaming match, I think, while like fighting and stuff is going on.
Yeah.
About how she's like, I'm not going to get a card for something I'm only going to use once a year.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
It's only worth the value if you buy in bulk, and I just don't buy that much.
Yeah. There's a ton of like really good scenes like that.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I'm curious to hear what other people think. I haven't heard a ton of reports back from the front. It is on DC streaming, which not everybody's got. So.
Right.
Well, and also I think DC definitely shot themselves in the foot by canceling Swamp Thing and basically scaring a bunch of people off of their app, so even
right.
people who did in the past may not be listening
to it. They don't
have
total confidence, exactly.
Yeah,
that definitely is what lost me. I mean, it wasn't the only thing, but that was definitely one of the things that lost me from the DC app.
That said, I do really recommend that, like, if you can even, you know, test this out on, like, a free trial. It's super mm-hmm. fun. I don't know if it's entirely worth the subscription.
We'll get you a sign-in. You can give it a shot.
All right.
What else we got?
Okay, so let's talk about the Crisis on Infinite Earths. Not the comic, but the TV show, which is a 5-part crossover runs the CW shows.
Which ones do we got? Arrow.
It starts in Arrow. Second part is Batwoman. Third part is Flash,
Actually, it started in... Oh, I thought it started in Supergirl.
Oh, you're right. It started in Supergirl. Then it went to... Arrow has played such a big part in it, I forgot.
Right, they've been prepping
so
it.
Supergirl, then Batwoman, then I think it was Flash.
Okay.
And I guess it's going to wrap in Arrow and... What's the other one? What am I missing?
Legends?
Is Legends part of it? I guess
Maybe.
It is.
I think I had something spoiled for me about, like... then I guess probably will have something to do with how it wraps in Arrow, which is a bit of a
Maybe,
bummer.
Maybe, although it's not... No, because the Arrow part hasn't aired yet.
Maybe it's a supposition.
Yeah.
But I was like, okay, I can see this thing.
I think people are guessing at things.
Maybe so.
Anyway, Dave has seen part one, so we're going to talk about part one.
Then I'll excuse myself while y'all spoil whatever
else.
And
then we're going to talk about parts two and three. So, for the first part, the only spoilers will be episode one.
Yep.
Unless Anne or I accidentally left something slip.
Yeah.
But
honestly,
I don't think so.
Well, I watched all three of them at the same time, and I don't remember what happened in which episode,
so
maybe
Dave,
I ought to not.
What is the ending of the episode that you saw?
Let's see, they just had a big fight. It ends with a major character death, I suppose I'd say.
Okay.
And there's maybe a few minutes after that, but that's all I see.
Wait, is that in the first episode?
I think they wanted to make sure you knew there was going to be some weight to this.
Okay.
I do also want to say that's not super helpful.
Yeah, there's plenty of deaths, so...
Hopefully that doesn't
just
spoil
tell us,
anything.
Dave. Just tell us. Just tell us the character dice.
Arrow.
Okay, yes.
Cool.
I kind of, we suspected since they're ending Arrow, that he might die in the crisis.
And they set up throughout the episode that he was passing on his legacy to his daughter.
Yeah, and I guess he's been, it was kind of interesting, I don't watch these shows regularly, so it's interesting to come in and see where they are. So they introduced Mia Dearden from Kevin Smith's run, basically.
Yep. But not as a runaway, but as his biological daughter.
From the future somehow.
Right.
Weird.
Right, she's now, like, what, 20 or something?
Ollie's been talking to the monitor and preparing for the crisis, which is a little weird, but... like we said off mic, it was like, he is the Batman of the universe, so it kind of makes sense.
Yep. And just for those who don't know, this has to do with like a sort of an antimatter wave that's destroying all the different alternate worlds to fuel, the anti-monitor?
Yeah. It starts by destroying Supergirl's world, right? Like,
Yeah.
Like, what is interesting?
I guess the whole first episode is mostly about evaluating the threat, figuring it out. Actually, I guess technically it destroys Argo City or whatever first.
Well, there's also sort of a bit of an homage, because in Crisis, in the comics... Alexander Luthor survives the destruction of, Earth 3 or whatever. He's like the good Luthor, and his parents send him off to, Superman. They send him off not into another planet, but another universe.
Yeah.
And I feel like their baby Clark or Cal or whoever they're... Is it
Jonathan?
Is he Jonathan?
Yeah,
oh, right,
Jonathan.
The son of Superman,
So, like, they have Superman and Lois send him off, and it's a little homage, and I'm like, oh, did they just kill off their Superman and Lois? No, they didn't. They rescued him by teleportation, which I'm glad they did, because I like those actors.
For sure.
Have they yet found the kid in the where y'all are?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I was wondering if they were going to, have some weird time dilation thing, so they could have him grow up, and they could do Superboy thing.
No, I believe...
They found the kid where you are.
He's still a baby.
Oh, I guess so. Well, I didn't know what could have happened since then.
I don't believe there's any more loss or finding of the kid.
But the first episode is very much about the sort of attempted evacuation of Supergirl's world and big fights with these kind of shadow demon creatures that are the pawns of the anti-monitor.
Yeah. Anna, have you read Crisis?
I haven't. I tried.
Yeah. So I think in this room, there aren't any big Crisis fans. Like, I've read it.
Yeah.
I maybe have read it twice, and I find it mostly not great. Even though I have a huge fondness for alternate worlds and big earth-shaking crisis stories, it should be right up my alley, but it's mostly just Greek to me.
Yeah, like even knowing all those characters, it's almost, they literally just kind of cram too much stuff.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to get, it's hard for me to feel that emotional attachment and find scenes really compelling when there's just 100 cameos a minute.
And there's a little bit of that in this, to be honest. I feel like the emotional consequences aren't as strong because I'm like, well, you're probably going to bring all these people back, so I don't know that I believe that all this is really death.
It is planned with a smaller cast, though, that than, say, the comic, and I think that does help. It also, I think, is kind of one of the things that made, say, Civil War work in the Marvel movieverse.
I was going to make that same comparison, because I know there were some people who were like, they'd put up these pictures of, like, here's Civil War in the comics, and it's, like, hundreds of characters coming together, and here it is in the movies, and it's, like, 16 coming together at the airport, and I'm like, you know what? I understand what you're saying, but honestly, the airport version's better.
Yeah, it's true.
And I think that that's the case with the show, too. It's like, I don't need there to be Detective Chimp in the background running at them. I just want the, like, 10 characters. Ollie's sacrificing himself to stop the Shadow Demons, and basically they make a point of, they're like, yeah, in his last minutes, he saved a billion lives. I'm like, that's pretty cool.
I liked that they made it so concrete and made sure that they're like, if this guy is going to go, we're going to make sure you know that he saved, you know, like a continent's worth of people.
Yeah, that he saved so many people in his last moments that it wasn't just pointless. I thought that was really good.
There's there's a neat scene in there. There's, you know, some of the lines are, you know, they have some fun in the episode too. I liked what was the bit where they Batwoman is kind of snarking at them, and then Supergirl, who's her like one confidant, says, "Hey, you can trust the people in this room," and she takes off her mask, and they see that it's Kate Kane, who I guess they'd had a run-in with before.
Yeah.
And Green Arrow is like, yeah, that tracks. Like, immediately, like, it's like, yeah, you were a bitch to me before, you're now.
Yep. And also, I like somebody else is like, hey, Bruce Wayne is Batman?
Yeah, that's right, because the implications quickly trickle out. But there was also, like, some serious scenes, like, when there's an alternate future they go to with, the aging Ollie.
Yeah.
Who does he talk to?
To Sarah.
White Canary.
Yeah,
and she tells him something like, what, you're a hero in every timeline or every world?
Except you're for that a one good man in every timeline.
Except for she forgetting that he was a Nazi like two crossovers back, so not every world.
Don't ruin a good line.
I'm just
Look,
saying.
I didn't think about that, and you're right, it does...
You don't throw a caveat at somebody who's living in an apocalyptic hellhole.
I'm just saying... Sarah clearly thinks there's good people on both sides.
I mean, he wasn't just a Nazi.
He was the
fucking Führer. He is the Nazi.
She's like, you probably, in that moment, wouldn't ruin it, but like, you're a good man in all worlds.
Except the Nazi one where you're the Führer.
Randy, thanks for ruining me trying to say that there were some good lines that I thought were touching in this.
I'm sorry. I think that is the issue I have with all this. It kind of gets to it, is that the CW universe, while it's fun, and it's like, they're doing things that... I'm shocked to see on TV. It all is a little silly and cheesy for me. And as it goes on, I find myself having less and less purchase in this world. It reminds me, like, the MCU I love, and it really gets me on an emotional level. The CW stuff is just a little bit slightly more low rent, and it doesn't quite connect for me on the same level.
Right. Well, it's TV budget, and there's, like, 800 episodes as opposed to, like, 20 movies. Yeah. So.
Also. They don't have the backing of a corporate media giant behind
them.
They
have Time Warner.
I mean, yeah, but that's not Disney.
That's true.
They did pick their speed early on.
Yeah, they did.
Arrow was the closest they had to being serious, and it was like action-adventure serious. Yeah. It wasn't serious.
I do love all the cameos here, which I think in Crisis in the comic it can kind of be a detriment, but here it's like the bonus. It's like the frosting.
So yeah, what did we get? Knox, the reporter from Batman 89.
Yeah, good. Aged Burt Ward. Holy Crimson Skies of Death.
So funny. Hawk and Dove from Titan show.
Yeah,
that was a bit of a surprise to me.
As they go on, they're hitting every single thing.
Mm-hmm.
They really are hitting like all the different DC universes. Even these, most of which were
they haven't
shows,
done much with like the movie stuff in general, right? Like
no, I mean Batman 89 was the closest thing.
Did they mention Brandon Routh's Superman?
He is canonically Christopher Reeve's Superman.
Oh, okay,
Routh was the continuation of Christopher
Reeve's
Superman.
True. That's true.
They canonically mention it, and I won't say I don't think it's until the second episode that there's that line. It's a great line, but we'll talk about it when you leave the room, Dave.
Right. Should I do that and y'all can move on?
Yeah, you have any other points to make about part one?
No,
you're gonna watch parts 2 and 3, right?
What
you're gonna watch the rest?
Yeah, yeah. I definitely enjoyed it enough to continue watching, and I generally found it a good romp. If you need some if things are a little bit down too serious in the world right now, go to Crisis on Infinite Earth where everybody knows your name.
All right. All right, so we Harbinger teleported Dave out to go run a side mission, and now Anna and I are going to talk about parts 2 and 3.
Yeah.
Probably together, because I don't remember which ones were in which part either.
Wait, we're talking about Crisis without Dave?
Yes.
I thought Harbinger teleported him out so that I could say mean things.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's fine, too. Oh,
okay.
Oh, are you not a good person in every universe, Anna?
No, I don't even know if I'm a good person in this universe.
So, one of the things that I really like in this, I don't want to say too much about it, because it definitely deepens part 2 and 3, is that their world's finest is Batgirl and Batwoman and Supergirl.
Yeah.
Like, I love the relationship between the two of them. I love the whole Kryptonite runner.
Yeah.
And I love that basically when Batwoman stands up to her, it's not about Supergirl going dark, it's that she might destroy the universe trying to fix things.
Yeah, it's super cool.
She's like, hey, maybe stand down and maybe you can't fix everything.
Yeah.
And that's only a thing a mortal could do to someone like Supergirl, who's like, no, everything's fixable.
Yeah.
And Kate's like, no, I lost my parent, like, I lost my mom and my sister, like, things, you can't fix everything.
Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting. I liked it.
Yeah, and I mean, specifically, like, one of the things that I do like about that, like, exact conversation is, like, I guess when, at the end of that confrontation, when she gives her back the Kryptonite, and she's like, I'm giving you this because even though you're the Avatar of Hope and I'm the Avatar of Courage or whatever their
terminology was,
it's like, I'm giving this to you because I'm hopeful that I will never have to use it.
Yeah.
And, like, Supergirl is like, of course, well then, and you take that because I am, like, courageous enough to know that you'll never need it.
Yeah.
And it's like, that in and of itself was, like, such a great, great moment.
Yeah, it's really good, and I love that relationship between them. I love the cameos we start seeing when they open with, like, Birds of Prey, and it's getting, like, wiped out, and...
Which I thought was wild, because that show was not successful.
No, but I liked it. Like,
yeah, it was fun.
Also because Ashley Scott, who played Huntress, is not bad casting.
No.
It's just that it was a badly written show.
Shows often are.
Yeah, I'm glad they got the little nod, and Brandon Routh's Superman is so good.
Oh, he's so good.
Yeah.
It's so strange when I think about that, because, like, his Superman movie was one of the, I guess, like, first big superhero things that I, like, remember seeing beyond, like, Batman and Superman animated series.
And did you fall asleep during it? Because it was boring as hell?
No, I actually, it's weird, I actually really liked it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, of course, I was, like, you know, like, 14 or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, I'd never really had any real exposure to Superman.
Right.
And sure, like, people endlessly meme on that scene with Kevin Spacey where he screams wrong in Lois's face. But, like, ultimately, I didn't have any huge problems with it.
Okay.
Not that I knew any problems to have.
Right.
But I guess sort of seeing him make his cameo alongside, his name is still
Tyler Hoechlin? The other Superman?
No. The Batman who was...
Oh, Kevin Conroy. Batman.
Yeah, Kevin Conroy. Jesus, I don't know why that was so hard for me to remember. But yeah, seeing Kevin Conroy playing even an evil Batman and seeing Brendan Routh playing Superman again, like, those were the things that sort of got me into comics.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so it was really emotionally resonant.
I was disappointed in Kevin Conroy because...
Really?
I thought they were going to do a Kingdom Come thing because he's definitely playing the Kingdom Come Superman.
I was hoping so, too.
And I thought that, okay, well, this is going to be the... He's still going to be Batman, but instead it's like an eviler Dark Knight version who killed Superman.
Yeah.
And also... Kevin Conroy is Batman to me. Like, he is the voice of Batman.
Yeah, for sure.
Kevin Conroy does not look like any Bruce Wayne we've ever seen.
He doesn't.
And it was, God bless him for giving the voice actor a chance to actually live action act, but man, does he not look like Bruce Wayne at all.
Yeah, he...
I almost wish they'd just put him in a CGI suit or something.
Yeah. Well, weirdly enough, like, I didn't think he was a bad actor.
Yeah, no, he's fine. He's good. He's just, he doesn't look like any kind of Bruce Wayne.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. For example, I don't think that, like, Christian Bale looks like any kind of Bruce Wayne.
That's fair.
So, like, I guess, like, that in and of itself is not something that bothers me so much. But, like, I think they even played, like, a stinger from the Batman animated TV series, like, theme song.
Oh, they do a lot of that music,
going into it. And I was hoping for a Batman animated series, like, in the way that, I guess, Brendan Routh's Superman was showing up in this. But instead we got, like... darker Frank Miller Batman.
That was the thing. Like, I felt like they didn't serve the actor. Like, I wanted him to be the older Bruce Wayne from Batman Beyond.
Yeah.
Who he played.
That was what I was hoping, especially when I saw Luke Fox. I was like, sure, it's not Terry,
but Luke,
like,
being Batman Beyond would have been amazing.
Would have been super cool.
Yeah.
In fact, that is probably my only major gripe with it.
I was disappointed in that, too. Lex Luthor, John Cryer's Lex Luthor, he's having so much fun being evil.
I know. It's wild.
And he is evil.
Oh, man, he's
freaking horrible.
He they're in the middle of this crisis where all the universes are wiped out. He's like, I'm going to take this book and go kill the Superman.
Yeah.
Like, what is wrong with you?
And the fact is, it's not even enough for him. It's like, he gets like halfway down the list and he's like, actually, I'm bored of killing Superman.
What if I write my name into the Book of Destiny so that I'm one of the seven people who survives?
Right?
I love the cheesiness of that he basically just writes Lex Luthor in.
It's funny because like he fills the role that like Dr. Doom does in the Infinity Gauntlet comic that I felt like was sorely missing from the Infinity Gauntlet story in like the Marvel movies. And so to see like something like a shitty villain being a shitty villain like in the midst of something so fucked up happening is so great.
He's like, look, I'm still out for myself even if I'm only one of seven people who's going to survive.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I thought the Smallville nod meant nothing to me. Because I hate Smallville. But
again,
did you enjoy
the
Smallville
nod? Yes. Yeah, like that was like another one of the I watched that with my dad when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And like my dad, of course, is like groaning through the whole thing because he's like, oh, this Superman is so boring. I don't like dumb farm boy man. And I'm like, oh, come on. But like, surely you have to understand that this is actually delightful.
Yeah.
At least on a referential level.
It's too bad they could have gotten Michael Rosenbaum back to play Luthor.
I was super disappointed. But I actually do like the sort of subtle implication because like, they show up and like on the farm and they're like, Clark, you got to get out of here. Lex Luthor's coming to kill you. And he's like, wait, what? Why?
Why is the president coming?
And I'm choosing to interpret that as that because like the Smallville universe was like nowhere near as dark.
No, no.
In fact, nowhere near as dark as the reality of some of what the Smallville stars did.
Yep.
Like that in that universe, Lex Luthor isn't evil. He and Clark are still friends. He's just the president.
Yeah.
And that's my interpretation there.
What other cameos did we miss? Because there've been a few. There's quite a few. Oh, they added Ryan Choi.
Pardon?
They added Ryan Choi.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
I liked Ryan Choi quite a bit. I wonder if they're going to make him the Atom. That'd be super cool.
That would be. Also, out of curiosity, and this is maybe my lack of comics knowledge, is he related to Grace Choi?
I don't think so. I think he's a character that Gail Simone created.
Okay.
But I don't think he's related to Grace Choi.
The only reason I'm curious about that is because I know that they also introduced Black Lightning into this mainline continuity. And Grace Choi is in Black Lightning.
Oh, yeah.
So
I like what they did with Black Lightning, where basically his universe gets wiped out, and he's like, I lost my wife and my daughters, and he's like, and Barry's like, look, man, you gotta keep moving. I understand it. Also, we did get the delightful head nod.
Which one?
Between Black Lightning and Diggle.
Oh, yeah,
when they show
super
up, which
good.
Is so good. Also, I just remembered the most important cameo of all, which was Lucifer.
Oh my god, like, I actually jumped off the couch. I was so shocked. I don't know how that didn't get spoiled for me.
I cracked up, and I love that
Constantine
and Lucifer together are basically... I would watch a show with just the two of them.
Oh, so would I. Honestly, I'm surprised that the CW hasn't, given Constantine his own show back.
Yeah.
He's great on Legends, but, the guy that they have playing him is, just straight up perfect.
Oh, he's perfect, yeah.
Yeah.
And the guy playing Lucifer is also great.
Oh, he is.
It was so good.
I would like an opportunity to, I guess, see him in something that's a little closer to what Lucifer is in the comics.
As opposed to a procedural?
As opposed to a procedural. And I think that if they mashed him together with John Constantine, they could do that.
Oh, man, I would love it if they did more of a Constantine-Lucifer thing. Mm-hmm. I think the two of them had great chemistry together.
For sure.
It was super fun. Also, I'm pretty sure it's the first time we've seen Jim Corrigan in this universe. The Spectre?
Oh, yeah,
and
I think so.
And that they're going to make Ollie the Spectre, maybe, which is kind of cool.
That would be awesome, actually.
And a nice nod to sort of in the comics where Hal Jordan became the Spectre after he died and was reborn after he sacrificed himself in Final Crisis or whatever. So I like that idea. I don't know if they're actually going to do it or not.
Yeah, I'm not. I mean, I guess probably that if they did, he would almost assuredly only show up in future crossovers,
right,
because I guess dying or being taken out of the show has hardly stopped them from giving older cast members the ability to come back in crossovers.
Right.
So
I like their use of John Wesley Shipp as the original Flash.
Yeah,
I thought that was a good way to do the Flash dies in crisis, and
same.
I thought that was really fun. I love I like their monitor. I think he's a doofy character.
Oh, for sure. He looks like he should not work on a television
screen,
but he does. He totally does.
Yeah. Their anti-monitor is a little goofy looking. He needs a helmet.
Yeah. Also, didn't they even show a piece of the Flash show from the 90s?
Yeah, they did.
They showed a little piece of it as a little flashback unintended.
Yeah, well, they used the notion that he and Tina had gotten married and had their life together, and that was kind of cool.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm really liking this. I'm curious what the last two parts are going to look like.
Yeah.
I don't know what... And I'm curious if they're going to do the thing where they bring all the continuities together now, or if they are going to roll back and just, like, everybody have your own show again and we have a multiverse again. Like, I don't know.
Honestly, I hope they don't roll back, like, at least putting them all in the same universe, because, like, there's something to be said for having, like, a show where, much like on the Netflix Marvel stuff, where, like, Danny can just come down and hang out with Luke for an episode. Like, I'd really like to be able to see, like, Batwoman and Supergirl, like, actually get to, I guess, have more than just moments together.
I would really like the two of them to have a regular, kind of thing, but we'll see. I don't know. They seem to like having Supergirl off on her own Earth, and Black Lightning certainly has a different tone than everything else.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, but I'm hoping that they are going to do the merging thing that they did. I'm curious. It doesn't matter to me, because I'm not going to watch 22-episode series of these. I'll watch the crossovers as always, pretty much.
Yeah, that's fair.
But, yeah, it's super fun. I enjoyed it a lot. It's got a little bit of that cheesy, campy thing that CW does.
Yeah.
But it's doing it pretty well.
Yeah, and honestly, like, if I'm being real, I would prefer generally that DC, like, lean into the campiness of their stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I don't need Arrow or The Hood as opposed to Green Arrow.
Yes,
or,
I agree.
You know, I don't need, like, tactical gear versions of costumes. Like, I actually want the camp in some of these instances, which I know is strange coming from me.
It is. You want Buccaneer boots, too?
I could pass on that. Like, but like Ollie can wear combat boots and a little green tunic thing.
Okay, fair
I'd be
enough.
Fine with that. Tunics are fine. Buccaneer boots is too far.
All right, I think we have run out of time, so we're going to have to scoot our Mandalorian discussion later. And Watchmen, of course, we probably will not get around to, because it's over now. It doesn't matter anymore. It's over.
Yeah, you're not wrong.
Yeah. So we'll close out with our traditional saying, although Dave's not here for it, and you have a different traditional saying. So maybe we should both go with our traditional saying
at the same time.
So 3, 2, 1.
Battle on, Xena!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.